welcome to the recordings of the Oldies Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club, kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.
Our last speaker is Mary Beard, the most famous classicist in the world. She's the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement. She was, until recently, the professor of classics at Cambridge. Many books include books on the Parthenon, the Colosseum, on Pompeii, and the emperors of Rome. She's extremely energetic. Only this morning, you might have read in the Telegraph her very moving words on the death of her late tutor, Professor Pat Easterling, Regius Professor of Greek at Cambridge. And she's here to talk about her latest book, Talking Classics, The Shock of the World, or the Old. Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Beard.
Brilliant, thank you, Harry. Can I start by saying I have a huge soft spot for the oldie. Because more than 10, almost 20 years ago now, when I was having a wee bit of bother with A.A. Gill about whether I was fit to appear on telly, the oldie did me the honour of making me their pin-up of the year. And I still have the certificate in the loo, right? Okay, this new book, maybe my last, is Talking... Well, we'll see. Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. It's kind of... It's meant to be high-fibre fun, but high-fibre... Definitely underlined. And part of the point of it, and this goes back to what Harry said about my old tutor, Pat Easterling, who recently died, is in a way to pay some homage to the people who taught me classics. And Pat Easterling, who was my tutor at Newnham in Cambridge, is one of those teachers who left a fantastic, lasting impression on me that I don't want anybody to be able to forget. Now, Pat was brilliant in teaching ancient literature, absolutely brilliant. You know, she taught me that engaging with ancient literature wasn't just being able to do what I was quite good at doing, which is writing a good essay and talking the talk and never really thinking about it, that engaging with literature was really about getting your hands dirty in it, not just being clever. But I have such vivid memories, some of which that I talk a bit about in the Telegraph piece. I mean, I remember going into this room that she had in Newnham, which was unlike when I was just up there fresh from school, unlike any other room that I'd ever seen before. I mean, it was beautifully curated, had a view over these gorgeous gardens, and it had something that I'd never ever seen in my life before, which was a revolving bookcase. And I remember thinking, how sexy is that revolving bookcase? And she used to teach us and engage with us in ancient literature to the accompaniment, depending on the time of day, of either tea or coffee or sherry. I remember very quickly when we were first taught by her, learning that if you were clever, you could time your tutorial so you'd get sherry rather than tea. You know, Pat would say, oh, perhaps you could come at 3 o'clock next Friday. And you'd say, can we come at 5? 5 was always sherry time. And I remember this vividly. I'm sure she knew exactly what we were doing. But my encounters with her were gobsmackingly unforgettable. And I remember one in particular, which I record in the book, which was when I was later a colleague of hers in Cambridge. And it was, this must be about 30 years ago now, perhaps more. And It was the age when everybody was preoccupied in education with transferable skills. You know, you had to say, people learn to do exams, and that gives them the transferable skill of being able to work under pressure. Right? So I remember we were sitting there in a meeting, and some bloke from the administration had come to talk to us about transferable skills, and he said, to open the meeting, what does classics teach you then? And I thought, oh shit, they're going to ask me that question. You know, what am I going to say? You know, I'm going to talk about the wellsprings of Western culture. I don't know. And I just hoped that nobody would ask me. Pat instantly said, and I was so grateful, it teaches you to read difficult things. And that was a kind of summation that I've never, ever forgotten. You know, that I'm sure Pat admired much of classical culture. You know, she worked on Sophocles, on Sappho. She was an enthusiast for ancient literature. I'm sure she was repelled by a lot of classical civilization too. But what she managed to do was to say, underneath all that, there is that sense that what you are learning to do is get your hands dirty in thinking very hard about things that you will never quite understand. And that is what is exciting about studying classics, other subjects too. It is the reveling in the difficulty of it and understanding that. And I was very interested recently, I interviewed Tom Hiddleston, you know, night manager, and he had been taught also by Pat Eastling. He read classics in Cambridge, and I asked him what he got out of it, and he said it was the ability to live in the doubt. And I thought, spot on, absolutely, that is what we were taught. And part of the book in a sense tries to encapsulate that sense of living in the doubt. I wish I'd known Tom's version of it before. Part of the point, though, is also, you know, to give an account of myself to the world. You know, I've spent 50 years now studying classics, more than that, you know, and somehow I've got a feeling that it's about time I said why I thought that was useful. And then it's very easy to take that for granted. So part of the book tries to say, this is why I think it is worth doing. I mean, it's a sort of kind of practice run for St. Peter, I suppose, you know, in a way. You know, how do you defend yourself? And I wrote the book quite quickly, and I think I wrote it quite quickly because, you know, it is the old lady in a hurry syndrome. I mean, people always say that young people are in a hurry to get things on, move things on, explain themselves. I think it's the old that are in a hurry. We know we haven't got much time left. So I wrote this to try to say, now, 71, don't know how much longer, but this is why I think that what I've done is something that I can live with and die with. You know? And I've tried to explain why I think that studying subjects like classics, the humanities, are not just kind of, it's not just a nice optional extra, it's not just kind of fun at the margins, it is absolutely central to a functioning democracy that people, in Pat's words, should be able to read difficult things. And I think I've also wanted to say that, and again, this is to go back to her, I don't think that the humanities are a pleasant to study. I mean, I think there's a very strong sense that, you know, it's nice to know about antiquity. No, it's not. It's tough and it's difficult. But it's essential. And I don't know if you've got... I've got a bit fed up, much as I admire it, with this year of reading that we're celebrating. You know, I love the year of reading and think it's great to get back to reading. But when people say that reading is good for your well-being, I kind of think, well, some of it is, but I've never found Kafka particularly good for my well-being. Reading is, in Pat's words, about being difficult. It's about facing things you don't want to face. It's not just putting your feet up and reading a good novel. I don't think that reading Euripides' Medea either is very comforting, if you want another example. I think also I've tried to say why I think it's worth teaching classics. I think classics is a wonderful subject, partly because it's so far away from us. It is a safe space where we can really engage with subjects we don't want much to talk about. I went quite recently to a comprehensive school in London where the kids, and I was determined not to intervene, the kids were talking about free speech. And after about 10 minutes of bright kids, it became absolutely apparent that they thought free speech had only been an issue since the invention of social media, right? And at this point, I thought, I'm not letting this go. So I gestured to Galileo and Giordano Bruno, but then I said, look, Socrates is the person you want to think about. What was amazing was that these kids were not only very interested in this, but their discussion of Socrates, none of them had skin in the game. You can say what the fuck you like about Socrates and he can't answer back, it's fine, was so much more impressive than their discussion of J.K. Rowling. Right? So I thought there is something here about how we can use the ancient world to face things we perhaps don't want to face. Finally, I suppose, I did want a bit to face up to the bad press that classics has had, still gets. There's, you know, it's a standard view that classics has been hijacked by the far right, that its inheritance is absolutely embedded in fascism, in Mussolini, in empire, and so on. Now, in part it is. That is absolutely true. But what I try to argue in the book is that classics has always been co-opted by things. It's been co-opted by the far left, it's been co-opted by the far right, and that's actually okay. You know, it's a living subject because people are interested in engaging with it. You know, what was Karl Marx's PhD thesis on? Greek philosophy, guys, right? And there's loads of other examples about that. I think that many of my younger colleagues get kind of worried and a bit hand-wringing at the idea that that classics has become a kind of poster child for misogyny, racism, white supremacy, etc. I suppose what I say to them is that they should just loosen up a bit, and this is one of the things that I say in the book, that if you don't like how someone is co-opting your subject, then you can't just go away and cry about it. You've got to argue with them. And I've had some quite good successes in arguing and made friends with people who are trying to use classics to defend positions that I don't myself uphold. I think the easiest one is all those people in America in particular who regard the defence of the gorge of Thermopylae in the Greek wars against the Persians as a huge, huge poster child for the far right. It's for white male freedom, right? And they quote bits of what Leonidas, the Spartan king, was supposed to have said. You know, when they invaded the capital on the 6th of January, they had slogans quoting the words of Leonidas. And there's a lot of kind of, in my profession, a lot of crying about that. I find that quite easy to deal with very, very simply. If you get into a conversation with somebody, the obvious answer to them is to say, who won the Battle of Thermopylae? Well, it wasn't the Greeks that won the Battle of Thermopylae, whatever their fantastic slogans. It was the Persians that won the Battle of Thermopylae. And what I think that we as a classics profession, or as interested people in the ancient world, what we need to do is actually just to argue about the ancient world. So the message of the book really is, probably we would get on better if we revered the ancient world less, and if we talked about it and argued about it and found it just a bit more interesting. So it's, I'm trying to throw reverence out the window and bring the argument back in. Thank you.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.